Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is an RNZ podcast. Kia ora and welcome to this Our Changing World podcast from RNZ with me, Alison Balance. Fish ear bones may be small, but when I visit Niwa scientist Emma Egan in her Hamilton lab, she tells me they're a treasure trove of information and a surprisingly detailed record of a fish's life.
I study fish ear bones, also called otoliths. That's the scientific name for them. And otoliths are calcium carbonate structures that are located in the inner ear of fish.
So we don't have them?
We don't have otoliths, but we have ears, yeah. And they kind of actually have a similar function, because ear bones help fish to maintain balance and to detect vibrations around them. So they kind of help them with their movement. But there's actually a lot more information contained in these otoliths or calcium carbonate structures.
All fish have them?
Yes, all fish have them, and they come in all different shapes and all different sizes, and they're actually really beautiful. People make jewellery out of them. They attach them to earrings and necklaces. They're kind of white, little pearly structures, quite attractive.
Have you got one you can show me?
I do, yeah. I have a couple of species here I can show you.
Those are ear bones that are all stuck down that sheet of paper.
Yeah, so these are longfin eels, actually, from Lake Hawea. And they're all female eels. So when we extract the ear bones to keep them safe until we go and analyse them, they get stuck to a black piece of paper. So you can see here they have, you know, all quite different shapes and sizes, and there's some serrations around here.
And so they're about, what, 3 mils long?
3 mils maximum length.
Maximum,
yeah. But normally they're about 1 millimetre.
And very irregularly shaped, but they're all eel ones.
These are all eels, yeah. And I'll just show you some flounder. So flounder are actually very different structure altogether.
Ah, describe these ones to me.
Very serrated edges, and you can actually see a very distinct white core. And that transparent ring that you can see is most likely the first annual ring, so the first year of growth in a flounder.
They look almost like miniature limpet shells.
Yeah, they do look like limpets, yeah. But they're quite serrated, you can see in the edges. And as a fish grows, the structure of the otolith becomes more complex. And they lay down calcium carbonate every day onto this structure. And it's because of this, the daily deposition onto the otolith, we can extract information about a fish every single day of its life.
So it's almost creating rings like a tree ring?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the technique and the method I'm exploiting for eels. So basically, if you cut an eel ear bone in half and burn it to enhance the annual rings, they have a similar structure to what you see in trees, where you can see a ring laid down every single year.
And burning it just makes those rings stand out.
Yeah, it enhances it, because the annual ring represents a period of slow growth in a fish, and it has a different chemical structure to the otolith material that is deposited in the summer. So the annual ring is also called a winter ring sometimes, and it turns brown or black by burning because it has a different chemical structure, and that's what we use to help us, guide us in the ageing process and to be able to see the rings a little bit clearer.
So these data sheets you've got here look quite old, so where are they from?
Some of these are from one of the first studies on eels in New Zealand on ageing, and they were done by a man called Peter Todd, and he used to work for Niwa's predecessors, and these ear bones were collected in 1975, 76, 77. So some of these fish are up to 20 years of age. So basically, by examining these old ear bones, we have a record of growth in Lake Ellesmere back to the 1950s. So what I'm trying to do is to understand how eel growth rates have changed through time in Te Waihora, Lake Ellesmere, and if there is an effect of climate change on eel growth rates. So I've generated a time series basically of 50 years almost, which is probably one of the longest time series of freshwater fish growth in New Zealand.
So how do you make a time series? You've got all these individual otoliths.
Yeah. So basically you start from the outer edge of the ear bone and you count every single annual ring.
Just like tree rings.
Just like tree rings. And you know the year you caught the fish. So you can assign every ring a year at formation. So, for example, these eels were caught in the Waitaki in 2004. And I know that the last ring was formed in 2003, 2002, 2001. And you work progressively into the central part of the ear bone. So for every individual fish, you basically are creating a time series of growth. And then you stitch all of your fish together that have shared growth in the same year to make an even longer time series. So for Lake Ellesmere, like I said, it dates from 1952 to 2013. And then what we do is we extract climate information. So information on El Niños and La Niña cycles, on the southern annular mode, temperature, the interdecadal Pacific oscillation. And we use those environmental variables and statistically model eel growth rates with those variables to see if they're responding to climate change.
So it might be that in a good year that the growth ring is wider because they had a good year. Next year might be colder. It's narrower. Does it work like that?
Exactly. And the good growth year might correspond to an extreme event like an El Niño or a La Niña or a regime shift in the interdecadal Pacific oscillation. Wind, if you think back in 1968, there was the Wahine storm in Lake Ellesmere, which resulted in the macrophytes being torn out of the system. And the lake actually changed state. And it was very windy as a result of that storm. And that is a very distinct disturbance event in the storm. And what's really amazing is that by reconstructing growth from all of these old collections, we can pick up some signatures of the effects of that storm on eel growth rates. And we can see basically from our statistical models that they are responding to how variable wind was over that time period, which we think represents the Wahine storm. And likewise, we also have picked up signatures of El Niño events in 97, 98. There was an extreme El Niño event that year, and actually that resulted in lower growth rates of short fin eels in Lake Ellesmere. And I guess we don't know how eels are responding throughout the country. This is just one location that we have had an ability to collect data from multiple people. There's a lot of NIWA scientists that have worked on eels, like Don Jellyman, Shan Crow, Mike Benchies, Peter Todd. So I've just kind of collected all of those ear bones and reused them. So we don't know how short fins or long fins are responding in different parts of the country. Of course, climate change has different effects depending on whether you're in the North or South Island, West or East Coast, rivers, lakes, that kind of a thing. So this is kind of just the first step towards getting to grips about how eels might be responding to climate change.
So you can plug in the trends that you're seeing from the past into future models of what might happen with them?
Yes, potentially. We do need to get a much better understanding of what affects annual growth rate in eels. Of course, they are part of a fishery in New Zealand, and fishing can have impacts on eel growth rates. That is something we haven't analysed yet in our model, how fishing activity might change eel growth rates in conjunction with environmental change due to climate change. So I guess we need to get a better handle of all of the impacts on eel growth rates before we can start to make projections into the future. But it's definitely possible. They do it for marine species where they have a much kind of in-depth understanding of their biology and ecology. But for now, we're kind of taking baby steps at the minute. This is one of the first studies of this extent, I guess, in New Zealand. And we're just kind of processing it and, deciding where to go next.
Tell me a bit more about the ring that's right in the middle, the first one they lay down.
So that the dark centre in the eel ear bone represents its larval phase when it was at sea.
So they breed somewhere?
Yeah, in the Western Pacific Ocean. We're not 100% sure yet. My colleagues actually at NIWA are going to be tagging migrating long fin eels with pop-up satellite tags. And of course, we have never really been able to locate where longfin spawn. Don Jellyman is the scientist that has worked a lot on this aspect of the eel life cycle. And it's considered the holy grail among eel scientists in the world, because a lot of other eels, we have managed to find their spawning grounds, but for the longfin eel, it's still the biggest question. So, yeah, a group of my colleagues next April are tagging longfins to try and find where they spawn. So that will give us a little bit more information about where exactly in the Pacific Ocean they might spawn. For shortfin eels, we have a little bit of a better understanding through tagging studies, and also some Japanese colleagues have actually found the shortfin larvae in the Western Pacific Ocean, newly hatched ones, and the larvae are called leptocephali. So we do have some kind of an idea of where they might be located, but we're not sure if longfins and shortfins have different spawning grounds. Do they change over the spawning season? Do they change between years? So those are all really big questions that we need to answer. And actually, there's a lot of information contained in the core of the otolith that represents the larval phase. So during that phase, there's daily ring deposition, not annual. So you can basically get an insight into the daily life of a larval eel as it's transported from its spawning grounds in the Western Pacific to New Zealand's coastline. And also, as they are moving through the marine environment, they're picking up the chemical signature of that marine environment, and that's all recorded in this tiny, tiny ear bone. And we actually have just launched a project where we're hoping to investigate the larval life of eels, of both shortfin and longfin, looking at the daily rings, looking at the chemistry. We're also going to be looking at the isotopes of the tissue of glass eels as they come into New Zealand, and using a technique called compound-specific stable isotopes of amino acids. Quite fancy, bit of a mouthful. But it's a very novel way that we're hoping can help us to assign their potential origins and where they came from in their spawning area. And it's quite nice because it complements some of the tagging work. The tagging work is looking at where the adults go to in the Western Pacific. And our question is, where do the babies come from? So it's actually really nice complementary research that we're doing. There has been some work done on the daily rings of the glass eels, and a little bit of work on the chemistry, again by Don Jellyman and co. But this time we are trying to get a much more holistic understanding by using the chemistry over its entire life, as well as the fancy stable isotope analysis, as well as the microstructure from different parts of the country that are influenced by different oceanographic currents, to try and answer the questions: are they coming from different spawning grounds, and are they using different dispersal currents and dispersal routes to come to New Zealand? There's so much information in the ear bone. They're like diaries, they're really, really fascinating structures. They're a treasure trove, really, and by using multiple techniques together, you can start to get a much kind of bigger and holistic picture and understanding. And look, if we don't answer these questions, I'm not going to shed tears, because it's all new information, it's all new science, and it's just going to, progress and advance the field even more and give us a better understanding of the larval marine life of our shortfin and longfin eels.
And maybe help solve part of the mystery.
Yeah, maybe. That would be amazing. And also, it's really important research from the perspective that where their spawning grounds are located is an area that is rapidly undergoing the effects of climate change and sea level rise and ocean acidification and increasing temperatures. So in order for us to get a better understanding of the recruitment of glass eels to New Zealand, we need to start to understand the larval marine phase. And, this is very much like our whitebait, where they also spend a part of their life in the sea. It's a very difficult period in their life to study. They're little tiny fish out in a big, massive ocean. And that's why you can't tag them, because they're tiny. It's very expensive to do a research cruise, and you might not be very successful at finding them. So that's why the ear bone is like the most critical tool available to us to help understand the larval phase of our freshwater fish. It's amazing how something so small can tell us so much. It can tell us growth rates on a daily basis, on an annual basis, on a seasonal basis. It can tell us their spawning dates. It can tell us their age. It can tell us there actually are marks on the ear bone that represent feeding. And when they transition from a larvae into an adult, these are check marks, so very distinct bands on the ear bone if they experience stress. All of the chemical information that is recorded in them, so information about the diet, so carbon and nitrogen that's recorded in the ear bone. Different water masses have different chemical signatures, so it can help us to figure out what water mass they might have lived in and been transported on. They're just fascinating. The shape of them can tell us about if there are different stocks and different subpopulations in the country. Yeah, they're fascinating. I'm an otolith nerd.
Thanks, Emma. Emma Egan is a freshwater ecologist at NIWA. I'm Alison Balance, and this Our Changing World podcast first aired on RNZ on the 24th of January 2019. All our stories, as well as written features and useful links, are at our webpage, rnz.co.nz/ourchangingworld. We are also available as a free podcast at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher and Radio Public. Check out our sister podcast, The Kakapo Files, to find out what's happening with the biggest breeding season on record for one of the world's rarest birds, the giant, flightless night parrot. If you'd like to stay in touch, we are on Facebook and Twitter at RNZ Science. Many thanks for your company. Bye for now. Ngā mihi.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.